All right, so this is bio 241. This is bio 241, and it is October 10th. I'm sorry, November 10th. And don't forget a test in 1 week over these two chapters, which is muscle physiology and blood and cardiovascular physiology. Okay, so I didn't get any of the lectures online over the weekend, but that's the first thing I'll do tonight, is put the audio files online because I know some people have been asking for them. And your tests, you should be getting back in lab, but I understand lab was canceled this morning. But if you want to come by my office later and review any of your previous tests, you're welcome to do that. Okay. All right, so we were talking about some functions of blood last time. And what were the two main functions that we talked about? Coagulation was one, and then agglutination is another one. So you got to make sure that you can use those terms properly. So coagulation has to do with preventing blood loss, right? Preventing blood loss. And agglutination has to do with? It's an antibody-antigen reaction, right? So two totally different things. And we were looking at this rather complicated diagram last time. All right, so this is coagulation. And what's the bottom line for coagulation? Oh, you don't have a projector? Okay, maybe we can fix that. So what's, that's good that you don't see the slide. So what's the bottom line for coagulation? What's happening? Fibrin formation, that's right. That's when fibrinogen, which is an inactive, soluble protein, is converted into fibrin. And then fibrin forms this mesh or network that traps plasma, traps white blood cells, platelets, and even red blood cells as blood is flowing out through a wounded blood vessel. Okay, here comes the projector. All right, so here are the three steps that for sure you got to know. All right, the first step is prothrombin activator formation. So where the heck is prothrombin activator formation? All right, it's right here. It's part of the common pathway for coagulation. All right, and so what is necessary to get prothrombin activator going? You need calcium ions, right? So that's an important blood clotting factor. You need to have the proper level of calcium in the blood so that you don't hemorrhage to death. All right, and prothrombin then can be converted into thrombin. So what can you tell me about this chemical compound, prothrombin?
Inactive.
It's inactive. How do you know that's inactive? Did you memorize that?
No.
No, because it has the proper prefix, right? When enzymes have a pro as a prefix, we know that it's an inactive form, and it can be converted at a moment's notice into an active form. And it's converted by what? Prothrombin activator. And thrombin is formed. So thrombin now is an enzyme, right? And so thrombin can convert fibrinogen. Is that active or inactive? It's inactive again. Again, just by knowing nomenclature, if there's a suffix with an O-G-E-N, then we know that it is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form just at a moment's notice. Let me get my arrow going here. All right, and that forms thrombin, which is going to form a blood clot. All right, so what are the salient features of this kind of very complicated diagram? Well, it tells you calcium is necessary. It tells you vitamin K is necessary for proper blood clotting function. But the other interesting thing in this diagram is that we see what? A nice positive feedback loop. Right? So thrombin not only converts fibrinogen into fibrin, but it also activates other important clotting factors, right, that potentiates blood clotting so that it can happen very, very quickly so that you don't bleed to death. And this is the step right here that's blocked by certain kinds of anticoagulation therapies. For instance, if somebody's blood clotting function is too sensitive or if it's too high. All right, so the three processes are prothrombin activator formation, thrombin formation, and then finally fibrin formation. But don't forget about this positive feedback loop and how some ions, right, are necessary like calcium. So would you call calcium in this particular sense a coenzyme or a cofactor, knowing some nomenclature previously that we talked about in the class. Is that a coenzyme or a cofactor?
Cofactor.
It's a cofactor. Somebody said cofactor. Why is that? What's the difference between a cofactor and a coenzyme once again? Yeah, a cofactor is a small molecule. A coenzyme is a big organic molecule that carries, that acts as a transporter, that carries other organic molecules from one set of chemical reactions to another. All right, but a cofactor is very, very small. All right, so what does fibrin formation look like? All right, so here we see some red blood cells, and you can see that they're all clumped together, not because of agglutination, but because they're trapped by these filaments of fibrin, the protein fibrin that has precipitated out of solution due to the conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin by thrombin. All right, so make sure you know that coagulation is what formation? Fibrin formation. So a lot of times when you talk to people, even when you go talk to doctors, they just kind of picked up the way of speaking about coagulation. All right, they talk about blood thinners. All right, but when you look at this, these pathways right here, do you see anything getting thinned out? Is blood actually becoming thinner, for instance, when somebody's given heparin? No, so blood thinning is really a misspoken way of talking about decreasing clotting function by altering clotting factors or decreasing enzyme levels, right, or by decreasing enzymatic levels of these different compounds in the blood, including aspirin therapy, because aspirin will prevent the synthesis of prostaglandins. All right, so where can we find some prostaglandins? Okay, right here. Tissue factor 3, thromboplastin, that's a prostaglandin. And when the level of thromboplastin decreases, then clotting function decreases. And so there really is no thinning of blood that's taking place. Right, so it's just a kind of a misnomer. All right, so I think probably the most important thing in this class and a physiology class in terms of appreciating control systems is how different mechanisms work together to bring you precise control and balance of a particular function in your body. What's that general term that we usually think about in terms of precise control and balance? Like what maintains homeostasis? Okay, negative feedback, that's a really good thing, for sure. All right, but how about in terms of the autonomic nervous system? What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? And why do you have two divisions? Oh, you have two divisions because they work against each other. It seems kind of like a feudal process. We've talked about this quite a bit. But when you have antagonistic systems working against each other, what do you really have in your body? Yeah, you have precise control and balance. So do you think it would be a good idea to employ some type of antagonism for coagulation? Is coagulation an important function?
Yeah.
Absolutely, right? So what happens if you were to damage a blood vessel, right, and collagen was revealed, starting off coagulation, but you had no way to turn it off? What would happen to somebody? Their blood would just form a plug in their cardiovascular system and it couldn't flow from one part to another. What's your impression of that scenario? How long could you live if your blood wasn't going to flow through your blood vessels? Well, not very long, right? Just seconds, right? And that happens to some people, unfortunately. It's called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, right? And I don't know of anybody really to survive that situation, but that does happen with some people. So your body has, under normal circumstances, the ability to break down blood clots, number one, and number two, to limit the extent of clot formation. Right? So we looked at those cascade mechanisms, right? When we turn on these different enzymes, that's a cascade mechanism with different levels of amplification. So it's important to form a blood clot very, very quickly. But if you cut your fingertip, all right, you want to stop bleeding at your fingertip very rapidly, and we can see that coagulation provides for that, but you don't want that blood clot formation to travel through the rest of your body. Where would you like to have that coagulation take place? Just on your fingertip, right? Not all over your body. And so there are mechanisms that prevent that. All right, when damage is repaired, activated factor 12 causes activation of kallikrein. All right, kallikrein is an enzyme, and it converts plasminogen to plasmin. Oh, what could you tell me about plasminogen? You've probably never heard of plasminogen, but what do you know about plasminogen already? It's inactive because of O-gen, right? And it can be activated by kallikrein very quickly. And the job of plasmin is to break fibrin down. So this is what happens after the tissue has repaired itself, but this also happens on the periphery of that vascular incident that's producing bleeding, and it prevents coagulation from happening all over the body. So you can see that plasmin is working in an antagonistic fashion to thrombin. Right, so you have thrombin and plasmin working against each other, but since they're antagonistic systems, your body has very nice, precise control and balance over clotting function throughout the body. Okay, so we need to talk about some kinds of anticoagulants because some people need to be on anticoagulation therapy. For instance, maybe they have a heart defect, maybe an atrium isn't pumping blood as vigorously as it should, so blood has a tendency to just pool in an atrium of the heart, and whenever blood stops flowing, guess what it has a tendency to do? It has a tendency to coagulate or just form a solid. And of course, that's one of the last places where you want to have a blood clot is in your heart, because that could cause a stroke or a heart attack. So sometimes patients have to be on anticoagulation therapy. And commonly, what's the misnomer that we use to talk about that? They need blood thinners. But are we thinning anybody's blood? No, if we look at their hematocrit, right, it's the same as before. All right, so don't forget, you need proper levels of calcium. Sometimes we can use certain agents that we call our chelators, and these take calcium out of solution. And these things are going to be sodium citrate or EDTA. These things can be used in a test tube, but they can't be used in a person. So if we want to take a blood sample from somebody and keep it a fluid inside that test tube, will be these chelators to prevent blood clotting from happening. Other compounds that can be used, all right, in vivo in patients that need anticoagulation therapy is heparin, all right, which activates antithrombin 3, which blocks thrombin. Right, so that blocks that positive feedback cycle, so that reduces clotting function. Also, coumarin blocks clotting by inhibiting activation of vitamin K, and vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium levels in plasma, which again decreases blood clotting function. All right, so there's an important interaction between vitamin K, right, and coumarin, which then affects blood clotting function. So how do you manipulate vitamin K in your body? How is vitamin K controlled, basically, in your body? Okay, right, so vitamins, just think about vitamins as being a kind of compound, usually a coenzyme that your body cannot synthesize. So you need a source from outside your body. And how do we talk about sources from outside your body? Okay, they're essential, they have to be in your diet. Right, so vitamin K has to be in your diet in order to have proper blood clotting function, right? And if you don't have vitamin K, you'll have extended clotting times and you'll bleed a lot more as a result. All right, does anybody know what a good dietary source of vitamin K is? Dark green leafy vegetables. Like, what's your favorite one?
Broccoli.
Broccoli, yeah. Broccoli is a really good one, okay? But there are a lot of people, like I can remember my nephews when they were really, really young, all right, when they were in 3, 4 years old, and they would be horsing around all the time, okay, running into coffee tables, thrown down in the driveway, right, flying off of skateboards and stuff like that, and invariably they'd come in with a bloody nose, right, and had a hard time stopping that bleeding sometimes because they were low on vitamin K. During supper, at the supper table, guess what? I could never get them to eat any broccoli or green leafy vegetables, right? And I would have talks with them and say, now, you know, remember that blood clot or the nosebleed that you had just a couple hours ago? If you would just eat broccoli, you wouldn't have to be losing all this blood from bloody noses and things like that. And so do you think they listened to me?
No,
absolutely not. So my nephews would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli at that age. So hopefully you've kind of outgrown some aversions you have to green leafy vegetables, because that's very important. The other thing that this says, too, is that the proper level of anticoagulants is very important in a patient. For instance, if you don't administer the right amount, right, they can form blood clots, and that can cause a stroke or a heart attack. Right? If you give too much Coumarin, what will happen? Well, they can bleed to death, right? Almost like my nephews. So the proper level is very important. So there is a very important interaction between diet and adjusting the proper levels of Coumarin. So when somebody's on Coumarin anticoagulation therapy, they have to be very aware of their diet. They can't eat like a pound of broccoli on Monday and then none for the next couple of days and get their clotting function measured, and then over the weekend eat a bunch of broccoli again, because their blood clotting function is going to drastically change. So when you're on Coumarin anticoagulation therapy, you should eat the same amount of green leafy vegetables every day, so it's easy to adjust your blood clotting function. All right, so some of these interactions are really important. Okay. All right, so please review your pulmonary and systemic circulations from anatomy. All right, so I'm not going to go over this stuff. But basically, maybe I could just ask you a few questions. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two sides. What are those? The left and the right side, right? And the left side pumps blood through which circulation? The systemic circulation. And the right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, right. Well, let me just see how much you guys remember about the heart. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Very good. A bunch of you remember some of your anatomy. So that's good, but review these slides, right? This is just kind of a trivial review of the anatomy of the heart, the pulmonary and systemic circulations. Okay, heart valves, you said were four. Remember, there's two atrioventricular valves, two semilunar valves, right? And you know all of this stuff already, so let's move right on to the cardiac cycle. All right, so the cardiac cycle is a repeating pattern of contraction and relaxation of the heart. All right, so the heart has these two phases, contraction and relaxation. For years and years and years, everybody was really interested in the contractile phase of the heart cycle, which means when the heart goes into systole. So systole and contraction are the same thing. And diastole is what we call relaxation. Right? And now people are interested in both of these terms, the function of the heart in terms of systole as well as diastolic function, because in order for the heart to pump blood, guess what has to happen during diastole? The heart has to relax, and during that period of time, blood has to fill the ventricles. So if the ventricles don't fill during diastole, you could have a nice strong heart, it contracts with vigor and it pumps, but if there's no blood in the heart, it won't pump any blood, right? So both of these phases are just as important. Good diastolic function is important for filling. Good systolic function is important for maintaining blood pressure and ejecting blood from the heart. All right, so both atria contract simultaneously, followed by the ventricles about a tenth of a second later. So that makes sense, because the atria pump a little bit of blood into the ventricles. That helps what? The diastolic function of the ventricles. Normal systemic blood pressure. Does anybody know what normal systemic blood pressure is? Yeah, we see it 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. What does this 120 right here refer to? Don't know if you guys talked about that in anatomy, but that is the systolic or the peak blood pressure when the heart contracts. right? And then blood pressure slowly dies away during diastole to about 80 millimeters of mercury. And after that period of time, then the heart cycle starts up again and the heart contracts and it goes back up to 120. Right? So when you measure your blood pressure, you get two numbers, systolic pressure over diastolic pressure. And this is for the systemic circulation. All right, now what can you understand about the pulmonary circulation? Think back to when you were doing some heart dissections. Which ventricle was bigger and thicker and stronger? The left ventricle was a lot thicker, right, compared to the right ventricle. And that's because the right ventricle pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, which is relatively small. It has a lot less resistance to it. And so therefore, the pulmonary pressure is about 25 millimeters of mercury over 10, right? So this is a much reduced, almost by a factor of 10, in blood pressure because there is not nearly so much resistance in the pulmonary circuit compared to the systemic circuit. And as a result, the right ventricle doesn't have to be nearly as strong as the left, as evidenced by just looking at the thickness of the ventricle wall. All right, so let's talk about some definitions of heart function. Yeah. Beta blockers will reduce the systolic and the mean arterial blood pressure, okay? But maybe not necessarily the diastolic pressure, right? And I tell you what, since you asked that question, right, we see these two numbers right here, and sometimes these numbers become elevated. Maybe they go up to 140 over 80 or 150 or 170 over 80. Or they could be 120 over 90 or 120 over 100. Either one of these numbers or both can increase. What do we call that when these numbers increase above normal? That's hypertension, right? And that's a very serious disease. And people that have hypertension don't know that they have hypertension, but that hypertension is killing capillaries and blood vessels all over their body. And as a result, all the tissues of their body are slowly dying as well, especially those that are highly metabolic, like the retinas and the heart and brain. So that's a very important disease process to become familiar with and become sensitive to. Fortunately, every time you go to the doctor's office and now even a dental office, what happens to you? What measurement do they take? They usually take a blood pressure measurement, right? And I can't imagine any other clinical test that is more important and has caught and saved more lives than just taking a person's blood pressure before any kind of healthcare visit, right? So if you know anybody that has hypertension, right, you should be really supportive of them because sometimes it's difficult to control. Sometimes you have to be on two, maybe three different kinds of medication. And kind of the bad thing about hypertension is that when your blood pressure is way above normal, you feel fine, but when it is regulated back down to normal, that's when you feel bad. So people have a tendency to not be compliant with blood pressure medication because they don't feel like their normal selves when their blood pressure is controlled. But nonetheless, it's all important because if they have hypertension, they're slowly dying as a result of that, right? So you got to be really helpful and supportive of people that have hypertension. Try to get them on their daily regimens of drugs so they can control their hypertension, right? So if you really love somebody that has hypertension and they're not taking their medication, should you say, "You got to take your hypertension medication or you're going to die"? Can you yell at them to get them motivated? Is that something good to do? No, because as soon as you start yelling at somebody, what's going to happen to their blood pressure? It's going to go up even higher, right? So it's really tricky to help people out in that regard, right? Always positive reinforcement when they're taking their blood pressure medication. All right, so let's talk about some of the indices of cardiac function, right? There's something called end-diastolic volume. And this is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. So what's happening during diastole? And do you have a picture in your mind of what's happening to the heart? End diastolic volume, is that a small volume or a big volume? It's a big, somebody said big, I like that. Yeah, because what's happening during diastole? Then the ventricles start to fill up, and as they fill up, they swell up, and so it gets bigger. So end diastolic volume is a large volume, right? As opposed to end systolic volume. Let's just hop down to this last one right here. End systolic volume. When does that happen? That's right at the end of systole, when the heart contracts. So can you picture in your mind what happens to the ventricle chamber when, after contraction, it shrinks down, ejecting blood out of the heart, right? So end diastolic volume is the large volume, end systolic volume is the small volume. And the difference between these two, well, how would you think about the difference between end diastolic and end systolic volumes? That's a difference in the volume of the ventricle. Okay, and where did all that blood go? How come the ventricle changed size? Because the heart contracted and the blood was ejected out of the heart. Okay, and that amount of blood that's ejected from a ventricle during systole is what we call the stroke volume. All right, so that's the amount of blood ejected from the ventricles during systole. Right, and that's not equal to the end diastolic volume, because after systole, after the heart contracts, there's still some blood left in the ventricle. So not all of the blood is ejected. Right, so you got to subtract these two. Right, you take the end diastolic volume, subtract out the end systolic volume, and you get the stroke volume. All right, so which of these is larger, ESV or or EDV? Okay, yeah, the larger one is what, end diastolic volume. Okay, what is the stroke volume if the end systolic volume is 20 and the EDV is 80? All right, so can you just write this nice, simple relationship down? What do we got? Stroke volume is equal to what? End diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. All right, so you might have to bring your calculators to the next test again. All right, so what would be the stroke volume? What do we got? EDV is what? Is 80? Minus systolic volume is 20, so what is that? 60 mLs. That would be the stroke volume of this particular heart. All right, does anybody need the sign-in sheet? Okay, I'll just pass it back over to the right just a little bit. All right, so that's how we would calculate the stroke volume. All right, as the ventricles contract, all right, what happens to the pressure inside the ventricles as the ventricles contract? Think of a balloon. Say you got a balloon in your hands and you squeeze down on a balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it go up? Does it go down? Does it stay the same or what? It goes up, right? So as the ventricles contract, the pressure rises and that closes the atrioventricular valves. All right, so let me see if I can find a picture of these valves. So I'm going to have to bail out of this. All right, and let's look here. All right, so here we see a picture of the heart. We can see the left ventricle, right ventricle, right? And the left atrium, right atrium. And what do we call that valve between an atrium and a ventricle? Okay, those are the atrioventricular valves. So in particular, here's the tricuspid, here's the bicuspid or mitral valve over here. Okay, now how will a fluid flow? All right, we're going to get into a little bit of hemodynamics. How is it that a gas moves from one area to another, or a fluid? How does it move from one area to another? Okay, it will move, yeah, from high pressure to low pressure. So think of diffusion. You've worked a lot of diffusion problems, so just kind of use that model of diffusion. Molecules will diffuse from high concentration to low, but fluids will flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so during diastole, blood is flowing back to the heart into the left atrium, and then it flows right past these atrioventricular valves because the pressure in the ventricles are extremely low. All right? so the valve is open. But as the ventricles contract, pressure now gets to be very high in the ventricle and low inside this atrium. So what will fluid want to do if pressure is high in the ventricle and low in an atrium? It will want to flow backwards, or what we call retrograde. All right. And what structure inside the heart prevents that from happening? Yeah, these valves, like this atrioventricular valve. And it's important for these valves to work properly to prevent that retrograde flow, because if they don't, that eventually is going to kill the heart. All right, so as pressure starts to flow backwards, these valve leaflets slam together, and then that traps the blood inside the ventricle right here. Here is another valve. Right here is the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery. Notice that this semilunar valve is closed because pressure inside this artery is higher than the ventricle during diastole. Okay, and there's going to be a point in time when both of these valves are closed, and so the ventricle is going to keep contracting, increasing the pressure, but the size of the ventricle can't change because blood can't flow backwards into the atrium, and it can't flow into this artery right here because the semilunar valve is not open. So we call that a period of isovolumetric contraction, when both the semilunar and atrioventricular valves are closed. All right, so let me see if I can play a little bit of this animation right here. All right, so right now, we see that the ventricles are contracting, so the AV valves are closed, and the semilunar valves are closed. The heart is still going to contract, so the pressure is going to increase tremendously inside these ventricles right here. And when the pressure in the ventricles exceeds the arteries, then guess what's going to happen? Then the semilunar valves are going to open, and blood will leave the ventricles and go into the corresponding arteries. All right, so the chambers are still contracting. And when pressure in the ventricles is higher than the aorta right there, or the pulmonary artery, look what happens. Blood is ejected from the ventricle, both the left and right ventricles. Right? And at this point in time, the atrioventricular valves are still closed because there's high pressure inside this ventricle right here. All right, and then as the heart relaxes, okay, the blood has been ejected from the ventricle. The heart starts to relax. Ooh, let's pause it. Now the pressure inside the ventricle is less than these arteries right here, so blood starts to flow backwards. What happens to these semilunar valves? They close, right? But the pressure is still higher than in the atria, so the AV valves haven't opened yet. But if we let the heart relax even more, right, we'll see that the pressure in the ventricles decreases so much that there's higher pressure in the atria. And what will happen when the pressure in the atria is higher than inside the ventricles? The valves are going to open up. The atrioventricular valves are going to open up as a result. Okay. So now the heart is filling during diastole and the semilunar valves are closed. All right, so the heart cycle will just repeat itself over and over and over again. All right, so contraction of the atria happens first, followed by contraction of the ventricles, right, which closes the AV valves, opens the semilunar valves. Okay, and so that's basically the whole heart cycle in terms of diastole. And then here's the beginning of systole. But the atria contract first before the ventricles. Oops. Okay, so as the ventricles contract, the pressure rises, that closes the AV valves. And all the valves of the heart are closed, so this is what we call the isovolumetric contraction. Right, when the pressure in the ventricles exceeds that of the aorta, the semilunar valves open. Yeah?
Are the atria's actually contracting?
both atria contract at the same time, followed by both ventricles at the same time, within a reasonable amount of precision. Okay, maybe the right contract a little bit, but there's no clinical significance. Basically, we consider them both contracting together. Both atria contract, followed by both ventricles, right? Okay, in the normal heart. Okay? Okay, when all the valves are closed, right, those ventricles undergo isovolumetric relaxation at the beginning of diastole. When the pressure in the ventricles falls below the atria, the AV valves open and then the ventricles fill. Right, then atrial systole sends blood into the ventricles. So here is a nice graph that shows a number of important parameters of the heart. And the nicest, your book doesn't have a nice diagram like this, so that's why I present it to you, but your lab manual has a pretty good diagram of cardiac function. So we see a bunch of parameters versus time. Right, so we have the ECG right here, which is a measure of electrical activity of the heart versus time. We also have a sonogram. We have when your heart makes a sound plotted versus time. And we also have a number of different pressures. All right, so here we have pressure versus time. And then we even have a graph of volume versus time. And so this is really a nice chart to see how all of these things interrelate to each other with respect to the heart cycle. So when you look at this, you should know that how many phases does the heart cycle have? How many phases? I think I heard it. How many phases? You have contraction and relaxation. What do we call contraction? That is systole, right? So I want you to look at that one first. All right, I want to get my arrow back. So we got systole, and what is systole followed by? Diastole. And diastole is followed by another systole, heart contraction, right? Okay. All right, so let's take a look at, so systole is when the heart contracts. The signal for contraction is this part of the ECG, which is what we call the QRS complex. All right, so this is going to signal the heart to contract, and in particular, the ventricles. All right, so let's look at some pressure curves. Here is a pressure inside the aorta. So this is the closest thing that we can come to for systemic blood pressure. And this is going to be very close to what you measure, right, when somebody puts a cup on your arm and they actually measure two numbers. What are the two numbers that they're going to measure? It's going to be systole, which is about what, 120? Over diastolic pressure, which is this right here, or this right here, which is 80. All right, so the person right here is demonstrating a systemic blood pressure of 120 over 80, and what do we call that? Is that hypotension, hypertension?
No,
that's normal blood pressure, right? That's a perfect kind of blood pressure to have. Okay. And blood pressure in your arteries decreases during what period of time? Diastole, and then it shoots back up to a peak during systole, right? So this graph shows this very, very nicely. All right, this darker, what does that look like to you, blue? Okay, this dark blue line right here represents pressure inside the ventricles. So let's see what's happening. All right, inside the ventricles, you can see pressure goes from about zero up to a little bit over 120 during the cardiac cycle. It's zero during what phase of the heart cycle? During diastole. And that makes perfect sense because we want to have very low pressure in the ventricles, so what can happen? So that blood can flow into it, right? If there's high pressure in the ventricles, blood can't flow in, and then when the heart contracts, it can't pump any blood out. So pressure should be very close to zero during diastole, and that's going to fill the ventricles up. Then we have the signal for contraction right here, the QRS complex, and the ventricles start to contract. All right, so here we see pressure rising inside the ventricles. The last curve that I want to look at in terms of pressure is this one right here. And I have no idea what color is that. Does that have a color at all to you?
No.
Not very much. All right, this is the pressure inside the atria. All right, so we see the pressure in the atria is greater than the ventricles. So which way does this mean blood is going to be flowing? It's going to flow from the atria into the ventricles, because how does blood flow? High pressure to low pressure. So during this period of time, the ventricles are filling, right? And then we see the volume of the atria decreasing. That means what? That the atria start to contract during this period of time. And now the ventricle starts to contract. So here we have high pressure in the ventricle and low in the atria. Which way is blood going to want to flow? When it's high, when the pressure is high in the ventricle and low in the atria. It's going to want to go from high pressure to low, which is what? From the ventricle back into the atria. But what structure is preventing that? The atrioventricular valves. Slam closed right at this point right here. And when they slam closed, guess what you hear? You hear a sound, because it's a fairly violent reaction. Those valve leaflets just slam closed. Now, which is, and this is the first heart sound, so the first heart sound is the result of which valves closing? The AV valves or the atrioventricular valves, right? Because blood is trying to flow backwards from the ventricle into the atria. Now, all the valves are closed. The heart is still contracting, pressurizing the blood inside the ventricle, but both valves are closed. So what do we call this period of time right here? That's the isovolumetric contraction. So the heart is pressurizing, but the volume can't change because there are no valves open. But as soon as the pressure in the ventricle exceeds that of the aorta, guess what happens? The aortic valve opens, right? And blood flows from high pressure in the ventricle into the aorta, right? Things will always flow from high pressure to low pressure. And so this is what we call the peak ejection phase of systole, right here. So blood is leaving the heart, going into the aorta. So what happens to the pressure inside the aorta? As blood flows into it from the ventricle, its pressure increases, right? So it goes back up to the systolic level, and after most of the blood has been ejected from the heart, then the ventricle can't sustain the pressure. The pressure starts to drop, right? And what happens, okay, when the pressure inside the ventricle is that below that of the aorta? Then the blood is going to try to flow back from the aorta into the ventricle, so the aortic valve closes at this point in time. So this isn't drawn exactly right. This blue line should actually come over to right about here before it relaxes. All right, so here's where the semilunar valve closes. And how do these valves close? Nice and gently? No, they slam closed because these pressures are very, very high. That produces the second heart sound right here. All right, so the first heart sound is caused by closing of the AV valve. The second heart sound is caused by closing of the aortic valve, right? And these valves open and close based on the pressure difference from one side of the valve to the other. All right, so since the AV valve is closed, it's closed during this period of time, the aortic valve is closed, this period right here is what we call the isovolumetric relaxation. So we got isovolumetric contraction, isovolumetric relaxation when both the AV valve and the semilunar valves are closed. And we always see this little notch in the aortic pressure right here when the valve closes, right? And we call this the dicrotic notch. Right? So you probably saw that a lot in lab. All right, so what else do we want to relate this to? Let's relate these pressure changes to volume changes inside the ventricles. All right, so here we have, let's start here with, right here with systole. All right, so notice that the volume of the ventricle is not changing. So what do we call this period of time right here? This is isovolumetric contraction. Isovolumetric means what? That's when the volume does not change, right? So the volume is not changing. It's not changing because all the valves are closed, right? But as soon as the aortic valve opens, guess what happens to the blood in the ventricle? It gets pumped out, and what happens to the size of the ventricle? It rapidly decreases because blood is leaving, entering the aorta. All right. And then at this point, this is what we call isovolumetric relaxation. So again, the size of the ventricle is not changing anymore because all of the valves are closed. And then right here, look what happens to the size of the ventricle. It starts to increase again because what happens right here? The AV valve opens, right? And so blood can enter from the atrium into the ventricle, and now the ventricles start to fill up with blood once again during diastole. So this is a very powerful way to look at all of the important aspects of the heart, to see when the valves open and when they close, when the chambers fill, when blood leaves. All right, so let's take a look at this right here. Okay, we defined end-systolic volume, end-diastolic volume. Okay, and where I have the cursor right now, what am I pointing to? It's at the end of something. It's at the end of systole, right? And it tells us what the volume is, which is maybe, you know, about 60 or something like that. So what is that? What volume is that? Is that end diastolic volume or end systolic volume? That's end systolic volume. Okay, where would I have to go to find end diastolic volume? Like right about over here. All right, so here's end diastolic volume. And don't forget, which one is bigger, end diastolic volume or end systolic? End diastolic. So if we wanted to calculate the stroke volume, okay, I could probably ask you on a test, what's the stroke volume of this heart right here? You would take end diastolic volume, subtract end systolic volume, and then tell me what the stroke volume was, right, just by subtracting those two. All right, so make sure you can read these graphs, right? So if you need practice, you got to see me during office hours or with your lab instructor during lab to calculate these things. Okay. All right, the other thing that you should know from this diagram is when the first heart sound happens compared to when the second heart sound, what causes these different sounds. And the other thing that's nice to see is the electrocardiogram versus these mechanical events inside the heart. So the first wave of an ECG right here, this is what we call the P wave, and this signals the atria to contract. And do you see any evidence of atrial contraction? Yeah, well, let's look at this pressure curve in an atrium. Notice that there is a rise in the pressure following the P wave. So the P wave is an electrical event that triggers the heart, that triggers a mechanical event in the heart. So a P wave is not synonymous with a physical event of contraction. It always, what, precedes contraction. The same thing for the QRS complex. The QRS does what? It happens before or at the same time or after contraction of the heart. What happens first, the QRS or contraction of the heart? The QRS. This is just the signal for contraction, right? And then the heart contracts. All right, so maybe you should think of this as like being a stoplight at an intersection. All right, say you're at a red light at an intersection, and all of a sudden the light turns green. All right, so the light has turned green, but are you in the intersection already? Are you halfway through the intersection? Are you on the other side of the street? Where are you when the light turns green immediately? You're still stopped, right? And so what do you have to do? You have to say, oh, the light turned green. You got to take your foot off the brake. You got to do what else? Put your foot on the accelerator. All right, so what happens first, the light turning green or you moving through the intersection? the light turns green first. So think of the ECG as like a stoplight at an intersection. It precedes the mechanical events of the heart. So things have to happen, like what? Calcium flooding, the myofibrils, cross bridges have to cycle before the heart actually starts to contract. All right, so the ECG just is the signal for contraction. All right, so make sure you can figure out these different heart sounds. Right, closing of the AV valve and semilunar valves produces sounds that can be heard through a stethoscope. The first one, which we call a LUP, is produced by closing of the AV valves. The second is the DUP, and that's produced by closing of the semilunar valves. And if the heart is normal, when the valves open, they don't produce any sounds, recognizable sounds whatsoever. It's only when the valves actually close. But if a valve doesn't open all the way, you'll hear blood squishing through a valve, and that's going to make a swishing or squeaking sound, right? And that's an abnormal heart sound. That's due to stenotic valves or valves that don't open up all the way. And if that's the case, then you need a consult with a cardiologist to see the severity of that particular pathology. And if it's severe enough, then that valve has to be repaired or replaced because it's not opening. So valves can misbehave if they don't close tight, but they can also misbehave if they don't open all the way. Both, right? Both would be due to insufficient valves. And when valves make inappropriate sounds, we call those murmurs, right? So murmurs are abnormal sounds produced by abnormal patterns of blood flow in the heart, and it can be due to a number of different things. One we just talked about could be due to defective heart valves. They can be congenital in origin. Maybe the heart didn't develop right. And this is kind of important for everybody just to have a little bit of understanding. When do organs develop in a fetus? When do organs develop in utero? Does anybody have a good feel for when that is? Yeah, it's an early embryonic stage. We call that the first trimester. So organs are actually developing a lot of times in women when they don't even know they're pregnant. Okay, but it's very early on in pregnancy. That's one of the most sensitive times. All right. Also, rheumatic fever can damage the heart valve because your body might fight this disease by producing antibodies, and these antibodies can actually attack the person's own heart as a result of that. And other kinds of viral infections can produce heart disease by what we call an autoimmune disease, where a person's own body actually develops antibodies against their own heart. Oh, here's an interesting case. What's a dental carry? Commonly, what's a dental carry called? A cavity, right? And that's when this Streptococcus mutans and lactobacilli actually can use food that we ingest as an energy source, and they can grow on the surface of a tooth, right? And as a result of that, they'll secrete acid onto the surface of your tooth, and that erodes the enamel away and causes a dental carry. So dental caries are caused by what? Bacterial infections of the teeth. So what's a good common way that you can fight infections? What has humanity learned how to do? Like with the flu virus and even the swine flu virus. What can you do to prevent or to help prevent an infection from a virus? You can get, an immunization, right? You can get immunized. Well, there's some people that developed immunization for mutans and this lactobacilli bacteria, so people don't ever have to get dental caries as a result, just by getting an immunization. That sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? So you don't have to have dental caries. But unfortunately, as a result of that immunization, the person builds antibodies not only to these bacteria right here, but it also cross-reacts with the person's myocardial tissue. So when you get that kind of immunization, right, you won't ever have dental caries, but you won't have a heart either. All right, so as a result, guess what? What's the application of that particular vaccine? Well, there's no application for it because it cross-reacts with a person's own myocardial tissue. So until people figure out a way so that it doesn't interact with or cross-react with heart tissue, there is no such thing as a vaccine against dental caries, but that might happen someday. So developing vaccines, as you can see, sometimes is very problematic. Okay, especially heart valves. All right, in mitral stenosis, this is when the valve doesn't open up all the way. It becomes calcified, it becomes thick, and it impairs the diastolic function of the ventricle, so the ventricles don't fill up with blood. All right, and accumulation of blood in the left atrium can cause pulmonary hypertension. Now, the kind of hypertension that we were talking about before was systemic hypertension, 120 over 80. Pulmonary hypertension is just as deadly. It's more difficult to measure, all right, because where do you have to measure those pressures at for pulmonary hypertension? You have to go deep inside somebody's thorax, right, to their pulmonary artery. You can't put a cuff around any part of the pulmonary circulation, so there's no easy way to measure that. All right, so that's very problematic. All right, so stenotic valves can cause murmurs. Incompetent valves, when they don't close properly, can cause murmurs. And when you hear strange heart sounds, then that has to be evaluated with another kind of imaging modality, like echocardiogram or an MRI or something like that. People can also have septal defects. All right, so what's a septum in the heart? Where do you find a septum? Yeah, it divides the left side of the heart from the right side of the heart, and you have an atrial septum. You also have an interventricular septum. All right, so in the fetus, there is a normal foramen between the right atrium and left atrium, right? And so that hole is in the heart before you're born to bypass so the blood can skip going through the lungs, because what's the reason why blood goes to the lungs? To get oxygen, right? And if the fetus is not breathing, right, there's no reason why blood should go to the lungs, because there's no oxygen in the lungs for the blood to pick up. So there is a foramen between the right atrium and left atrium right here, right? And we call that the foramen ovale. Right, but as soon as a person is born, what happens to that foramen ovale? It should close over and become the fossa ovalis. But sometimes it doesn't close over, and that's called a patent foramen ovale. Right, and sometimes that's easy to diagnose because of the color of somebody's skin as soon as they're born. All right, if it's blue, what do we call that condition if somebody's skin is kind of bluish when they're born? Cyanosis, right, or a cyanotic condition that could be due to a septal defect of this atrium right here, and then that has to be repaired, right, that foramen has to be repaired, or that's eventually going to kill the heart. And the strange thing about that is that people can actually have a PFO or a patent foramen ovale until maybe they're 40 or 50 years old if it's a small leak before it manifests itself in any kind of clinical ramifications of fatigue, right, and not being able to undergo your daily activities. And then when we do an imaging study, even somebody that's 40 or 50 years old will see a hole in somebody's heart. And the nice thing is now that that doesn't have to mean open heart surgery. That can be done endoscopically, right, which is really nice, which means you're back at work within just a couple of days. As opposed to when somebody had a thoracotomy, I'm sure you're out of work for at least a month when that PFO was repaired. All right, but there can also be a ventricular septal defect. And here you see which way is blood squirting, from the RV into the LV or from the LV into the RV? Okay, so we see blood squirting from left ventricle to right ventricle. And is that always going to happen in that way? Okay. Which ventricle produces a higher pressure? The left or the right? the left is always going to be producing much higher pressure, right? Almost 10 times as much pressure. So blood is always going to squirt from the left ventricle into the right ventricle. Because remember, the right ventricle is just passing blood through the pulmonary circulation. And this turbulence in the right ventricle is easily seen with an ultrasound or an MRI. Right? And again, this septal defect has to be repaired because that eventually will kill the heart. But it's initially, how would you initially diagnose this? Because does everybody get an echocardiogram or an MRI as soon as you're born? No, right? I'm sure hardly any of us have had an MRI exam of our heart or an echocardiogram, right? You would, again, look at just the color of the individual when they're born. If they're cyanotic, this is one of the things that you would suspect. But even just by listening with a stethoscope, you would hear this squishing sound during systole. Okay, and so if you hear some abnormal heart sounds or the color of the individual isn't good, then of course you would get the imaging study to find out what the abnormality in the heart is. All right, so this would be a ventricular septal defect as opposed to this condition up over here, which would be what? An atrial septal defect. All right, so here is a question. Let me read the question. Why does blood always squirt from the left ventricle into the right ventricle? Because of pressure, right? Fluid will always flow from high pressure to low, and the left ventricle is always going to be developing a lot more pressure. All right. And you see that slide that shows that very clearly. Oh, no. I don't have right and left ventricular pressures. I just have left ventricular pressure right here. All right, let's talk about some electrical activity of the heart. So can you remember what a myocardial cell looks like underneath the microscope? Are they long? Are they striated? They're branched. They're short, all right? They're branched, all right? And they are striated, so they have sarcomeres. Right, and because they're short, they're connected to each other by intercalated discs, right, that have special junctions so that the cells are adhered to each other so that they don't pull apart. But there's also something else in that intercalated disc. There is a gap junction. And so how do you think of a gap junction? It's a nice microscopic hole or a channel that ions can pass through, in particular sodium ions, right? So that when one cell depolarizes, how would you usually describe depolarization of a cell? Sodium entering the cell. So sodium is at a high concentration in one cell. It's going to flow through a gap junction into a neighboring cell just by diffusion, right? And that depolarizes the neighboring cell. And then that then depolarizes the next neighboring cell, and that depolarizes the next neighboring cell throughout the whole heart. So the heart muscle is what we call a functional syncytium because gap junctions connect all of the myocytes together. So an action potential originating in any cell is what? Transmitted to all other cells within the myocardium. With the exception that there is the fibrous skeleton between the atria and the ventricles, right? The fibrous skeleton that the heart valves are connected to, but that fibrous skeleton doesn't have gap junctions. It's connective tissue. As a matter of fact, it's not even muscle tissue. So the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricles because of that fibrous skeleton. So sometimes the heart can actually contract, right, if it's abnormal, in an uncoordinated way. The atria contract irrespective of what the ventricles do. So let's take a look and see why this happens. All right, so here we see both atria and both ventricles. Here is the sinoatrial node. It's very, very close to the superior vena cava. And in the normal heart, this acts as the pacemaker of the heart. This has autorhythmicity. As a matter of fact, all of the myocytes of the heart exhibit autorhythmicity. They will all depolarize at a certain point in time. It just so happens that the nodal cells of the SA node have the most rapid rate of depolarization, and so they reach threshold before other cells in the heart do. And when it reaches threshold, what happens? When the SA node depolarizes and when it reaches threshold, what happens at the SA node? An action potential ensues, and that action potential flows over the whole heart, right, because of those gap junctions. Okay, we're going to talk about some of these special characteristics of the heart. Basically, the heart can be broken down into two main kinds of tissues, right? They're all myocytes. One is going to be the contractile cells, and the other are going to be the conducting cells. So these conducting tissues right here are just specialized myocytes. They don't contract. They're just here to transmit action potentials in a very specific way. All right, so let's look at the electrical activity at the SA node. So what kind of cells do we have in this SA node? They could be nodal cells or contractile cells. Nodal cells have different electrical properties compared to contractile cells, and these are nodal cells. So when we measure the electrical activity of a nodal cell, this is what it looks like. All right, notice that. What can you tell me about a resting membrane potential? You see a flat line anywhere in here? Not really. It doesn't really look like there is a resting membrane potential because the heart really is never at rest. It's always going to be either in diastole or systole, one followed by the other. Right? It does reach a negative voltage of about minus 60 millivolts. What was the resting membrane potential for most cells that you're aware of? Yeah, about minus 70, right? So it doesn't even reach minus 70. Right? But when it reaches this membrane potential right here, it doesn't go into rest. What immediately does it do? It starts to, what do we call this, rise in the membrane potential? It's called depolarization, right? So it goes up towards zero. This activity of a nodal cell is what we call a pacemaker potential. All right, so this is another kind of potential. What are some other potentials have we looked at already? Resting membrane potential is one. What's another one? Action potential is another. Oh, graded potential, that's another one. Okay, and these are all due to different kinds of proteins that are in the membrane, right? Like the, what's a graded potential due to? What kind of protein? That's due to a ligand-gated channel. What kind of protein is responsible for an action potential? Voltage-gated channels, right? So you should always be thinking of these things. All right, don't forget we had receptor potentials on certain organs, and when we looked at the sensory chapter, here is another kind of potential. This is what we call a pacemaker potential. Notice that it is slowly depolarizing because it's due to other kinds of membrane channels that are positioned specifically in nodal tissue of the heart, like the SA node. And these are HCN channels. So you could probably figure out what an HCN channel is. What kind of ion and how does it have to move to depolarize a cell? What's a classical way of understanding depolarization? A sodium channel, right? So here are sodium channels, and it's an HCN channel, that leak sodium very slowly all the time. And as they leak sodium into the cell, guess what happens? It slowly depolarizes. Right, and when that depolarization reaches threshold right here at about minus 40 millivolts, guess what happens? An action potential ensues, right, when it reaches threshold, but the action potential on a nodal tissue is due to voltage-gated calcium channels. So now calcium channels open up. There's high calcium outside the cell, low inside, so what does calcium like to do? Run down its concentration gradient, but it's also still negative inside the cell, so that negative charge inside the cell is drawing calcium inside. So this phase is very rapid, right? So the depolarization of this nodal tissue is due to Right, these calcium channels. So here is the first phase of an action potential of nodal tissue due to calcium. The second phase, what's the second phase called? Yeah, what's the second phase of an action potential called? That's repolarization or hyperpolarization. And what's that always due to? Potassium leaving, right? And so the nodal tissue repolarizes, but it doesn't go to rest because of these HCN channels that always remain open. It slowly starts to depolarize, and when it reaches threshold, an action potential ensues again. And this happens, what? Forever and ever through your whole lifetime, hopefully, right? Otherwise, that's the end of your lifetime if that doesn't happen. All right, so these pacemaker potentials, depending on the slope or the number of channels that are open, will adjust the heart rate. So if the slope is very shallow, what happens to the action potential? It's delayed. If the slope is very rapid, what happens to your heart rate? It increases, right? It reaches threshold more quickly. Okay, so all the tissues in the heart can spontaneously depolarize. It's just that the nodal tissue is the fastest, but if the nodal tissue of the heart, the SA node, maybe becomes damaged because of a heart attack, then other tissues inside the heart can become the pacemaker. And when other tissues inside the heart become the pacemaker, we call that an ectopic pacemaker. All right? So other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active, but they're slower than the SA node, so they don't capture the heart rate. They can be stimulated to produce action potentials by the SA node before they spontaneously depolarize. And if action potentials from the SA node are prevented from reaching these different tissues, they'll generate their own pacemaker potentials and cause the heart to contract. All right, so that's the nodal kind of tissue. Let's look at the contractile cells, right? The myocardial cells themselves. All right, myocardial cells have an RMP of about minus 90 millivolts, all right? But when they depolarize to threshold, they can trigger an action potential as well. And usually that depolarization comes from the SA node. So when we look at this graph of voltage versus time, does this action potential look anything like this one here? How would you maybe describe the difference? It's a lot longer, right? So here is what we call a plateau region. All right, so the kind of cell that develops this kind of action potential is a myocardial cell, not a conducting cell, but a myocardial cell that is specialized for contraction. So here we see RMP, and when it reaches threshold due to a pacemaker potential, right, that opens up voltage-gated sodium channels, sodium rushes inside the heart cell, and what do we call that? This is depolarization, right? But there are also calcium channels inside the heart cells, and they open, but they're relatively slow in opening, and they're slow to close. So the calcium channels open and stay open, allowing calcium to enter the cell. What does that do to the electrical property of, or the membrane potential of the cell when calcium is entering? That's causing depolarization, right? So this plateau phase in a heart cell is long, and then finally the calcium channels start to close, and the potassium channels open up, and that causes repolarization. All right, so this plateau phase in the myocardial cell is caused by a calcium channel that remains open. All right, now when we looked at neurons, remember we were looking at refractory periods. All right, what was this period called? Once depolarization started before repolarization began. What period is this right in here? This is the absolute refractory period. And the absolute refractory period of an action potential means that action potentials cannot summate. And this is really important for myocardial tissue, because this is indeed an absolute refractory period. And what that means is that, unlike skeletal muscle, heart muscle cannot go into tetany. So the heart can't go into a contraction and then maintain a sustained contraction because of this plateau phase right here, because action potentials of myocardial cells cannot summate. So what does that mean? Is that good? Have you ever experienced a muscle cramp in your body before? Like your leg or your arm? Okay, that skeletal muscle goes into contraction. Does it relax? What would happen to you if the heart were to do that? It wouldn't pump blood, and you'd lose consciousness in 3 seconds, and then you would die after 3 minutes. You would be brain dead, right? So because of these calcium channels that are in the myocardial cells, the heart can't go into tetany. So you don't ever have to worry about going into, right, that kind of systolic failure of the heart, because the heart just can't go into tetany compared to skeletal muscle. Right, so that's due to, you should be able to relate that to these calcium channels that produce this plateau phase. All right, so make sure you can see the difference between nodal tissue with these pacemaker potentials versus myocardial cells that have this kind of action potential due to calcium channels that produce this plateau region right here. All right, well, let's see. Thursday, we're going to finish up a couple things on the heart, and then we'll be ready for the test a week from today. Okay, chapters 12 and 13. All right, so the sign-in sheet is around somewhere. Right here. Good.